Anyone need an outline tonight that doesn't have one? Anyone need one? Good. So take your outlines and turn back to page 4 in your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 23. Jeremiah chapter 23. We're dealing with what the Old Testament teaches about the Messiah, not so much about his second coming and kingdom and his reign, which there's an awful lot of passages on. We're focusing more on the first coming prophecies and how much can we learn about the Messiah from these pages before the arrival of the New Testament. And we're dealing with the three main divisions of the Hebrew Bible. So we dealt with the law. We began still in the prophets, which shall finish tonight, and probably also be in these segments, Lord willing, into the writings. But Jeremiah chapter 23 begins the chapter in verses 1 through 4, focusing on Israel's wicked leaders at the time of Jeremiah. He points out that the shepherds of Israel are worthless shepherds and wicked in verse 1, and therefore in verse 2, God will judge them. Because of their sin, the sheep are going to be scattered. He promises in verse 3, someday there'll be a regathering of the remnant. At that time, in verse 4, God will give them righteous shepherds that will feed them with knowledge and understanding and never be guilty of leading them astray again. But in verses 5 through 8, he focuses on the righteous king. But and while this is dealing with something currently with the second coming, there are several facets here that would affect what we know about the first coming. And verse 5 says, "Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, that I raise up unto David a righteous branch. He shall reign as king and deal wisely, and will execute justice and righteousness in the land. His days shall be saved, Israel shall dwell safely, and this is his name whereby he shall be called Jehovah, our righteousness." Again, he's dealing with the day when he will sit upon the throne of David, ruling from Jerusalem, ruling over saved Israel. What's relevant for our purpose in the first coming bracket is the concept that here again, Messiah will be both God and man at the same time. So verse 5, he points out, "They'll raise up unto David a righteous branch." And in fact, one of the Old Testament names for the Messiah is the branch of the Lord, the branch of Jehovah. If you look at the different branch passages, you notice it teaches four different things about the messianic branch. First of all, like here, the branch will be a king, which is the theme of the Gospel of Matthew. A second thing about the branch taught elsewhere is that the branch will be a servant, and that's the theme of the Gospel of Mark. A third passage points out that these branches are man, and that's the theme of the Gospel of Luke. And finally, it teaches the branch will be God, and that's the theme of the Gospel of John. And so in verse 5, we see descendant of David sitting upon the throne of David, ruling over saved Israel. So in verse 5, he focuses on his humanity. In verse 6, his name is Jehovah, our righteousness. And what this one has is all four letters of God's name in the Hebrew language. In Hebrew, God's name comprises four Hebrew letters corresponding to our Latin letters as YHVH. YHVH. And YHVH is the unique name of God, and he alone has this name. Now, rabbis will often counteract and say, well, the name of God appears in common human names, like Jeremiah, for example, which means Jehovah hurls, and you find in other names. That's only partially true, because when the name of God appears in these names, it appears only in the shortened form. Most of the time, two of the four letters, and now and then three of the four letters, never all four letters. And yet this descendant of David of verse 5 in verse 6 has all four letters of God's name. His name is, he shall be called Jehovah Righteousness. And what this focuses on then, that the Messiah will be also God himself. And put the two verses together, you have the God-man concept. And this was viewed as a messianic passage by rabbis quite frequently in ancient writings. And when this happens, he points out things will shift in Israel's concept because the high point of Jewish history has always been the Exodus. As Jeremiah points out here in verse 7 and 8, the rabbis often refer to God as the one who brought us out of Egypt. But when the Messiah sets up his messianic kingdom and brings about the final regathering, the final restoration of Israel, that will change. And now they refer to God as the one who brought us out of all of the countries where he has driven us. But again, that goes a bit beyond our specific theme in this conference. Altogether, we can derive 4 points from this passage. First of all, the Messiah will be descendant of David. He'll be a descendant of David in fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. Secondly, the Messiah is Jehovah. He has all 4 letters of God's name. Thirdly, the Messiah is the God-man, both God and man fully at the same time. And fourthly, the Messiah is a king and is destined to rule as king. Let's go on now to the minor prophets and look at Micah chapter 5. Micah chapter 5. Verse 2, Micah 5, verse 2, but you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, which are little to be among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall one come forth unto me, this to be ruler in Israel, whose going forth is from of old, from everlasting. Here again you have a double origin. He has a human origin and he has a divine origin. As to his human origin, he'll be coming from the town of Bethlehem. And to be even more specific, he points out, it'll be the Bethlehem Ephrathah, the Bethlehem of the tribe of Judah, and not the Bethlehem of the Galilee. And furthermore, he's coming unto me, he's coming to fulfill the purpose of God. But after giving us his human origin as coming from Bethlehem, he goes on to give a divine origin of preexistence, whose going forth is from of old, from everlasting. And this is a Hebrew word that is the strongest Hebrew word for eternity past. It's used of God in Psalm 90, verse 2. Psalm 90, verse 2, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So you find 2 more points about the Messiah. First of all, the Messiah will be the God-man. And secondly, he'll be born in Bethlehem of Judah. Let's move on to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 9. Zechariah chapter 9. Now, Zechariah chapter 9, verses 9 and 10 falls into a category. We have the first and second coming blended into one picture without the implication of a gap of time between the two comings. So verse 9, as we're about to see, we'll deal with the first coming, but verse 10 describes the results of the second coming when all weapons of war are removed from the land. Obviously, this is not the case today. And furthermore, the one coming on the donkey in verse 9 is destined to rule the entire land of Israel, and more to the point at the end of verse 10, to the ends of the earth. Our focus specifically is on verse 9. Now the background to verse 9 is verses 1 through 8 where he prophesied the conquest of Alexander the Great. And the prophecy you read about in verses 1 through 8 was fulfilled through Alexander. Now in contrast to what happened to Alexander, he writes in verse 9, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, your king comes unto you. He is just in having salvation, lowly riding upon an ass, even upon the colt, the foal of an ass." Now he begins in verse 9 with a call to rejoice. "Rejoice so greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, not to be afraid." The reason is, your king is coming to you. Your king, this one's a Jewish king, not a Greek king. He's coming to you, not against you, like the Greek king did. He goes on to describe this king and gives us three attributes. Number one, he is just. He is characterized by righteousness, something Jeremiah just told us in chapter 23, verses 5 and 6. Alexander died in a drunken stupor. Secondly, this one has salvation. Everywhere Alexander went, he brought death. And thirdly, this one is humble, brought low, riding, and the Alexander came in the pomp of power. And finally, we have the manner of his coming, riding upon an ass or a donkey, even the colt, the foal of a donkey. A foal refers to something not yet broken in, while Alexander rode on a white steed. What we have is the prophecy of the triumphal entry when he rides into Jerusalem, and he's followed by myriads of Jewish people crying out, Hosanna, Hosanna, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. And then verse 10 describes the second coming, which will come in power, great power, and finally set up his messianic kingdom. Now, what the rabbis had to deal with is how is it that some prophecies, like verse 9, describe him coming in a humble way, and other prophecies, like verse 10, describe him coming in a conquering way. And there were two different rabbinic views. Both were wrong. They failed to recognize one Messiah coming two times. But they came up with two different rabbinic views. The minority view among the rabbis was how he will come will depend upon the spiritual status of Israel. If Israel is righteous at the time of Messiah's coming, he'll come riding upon a great white horse. If Israel is unrighteous, he'll come riding upon a donkey. So it's going to be either or, but not both and. But most rabbis were not comfortable with this either or prophecy. And they felt every prophecy must be fulfilled. And so the majority rabbinic view was there'll be two separate messiahs. The first messiah was called Messiah, the son of Joseph, who will come from the tribe of Ephraim. He'll be the one to fulfill all of the suffering prophecies of Isaiah 53, right upon the donkey here in verse 9. And he will be killed in the Gog and Magog war. And after he is killed, then will come the second Messiah, the son of David of the tribe of Judah, who will gain victory in the Gog and Magog war. He'll raise the first Messiah back to life and then set up his messianic kingdom. And then we shall see the fulfillment of verse 10. And that was the majority of rabbinic view in ancient times up until the 1800s or so. Now, the New Testament solution is much simpler. The Bible speaks of only one Messiah, not two. One Messiah coming from one tribe, not two tribes. And therefore, the Messiah will come twice, first to suffer and secondly to rule. Now turn to chapter 11. We have a more extensive prophecy here. Now, this is a very interesting prophecy, and it's introduced in chapter 11, verses 1, 2, and 3, describing a devastation of the land, and the geography presents shows a devastation from north to south of the whole country. The kind of devastation that ultimately be fulfilled in as a result of the two Jewish revolts against Rome. First of all, the first revolt from the year 66 until the year 70, the second revolt from the year 132 to 135, as a result of those two revolts that brought about the massive devastation and depopulation of the land described in verses 1, 2, and 3. But having described the future devastation of the land, what he does in verses 4 through 17 is to give us the reason why the land is so devastated. And that's because of the rejection of the true shepherd in verses 4 through 14, and the acceptance of a foolish shepherd in verses 15 through 17. So let's focus on verses 4 through 14 primarily. We'll just say a few things about verses 15 through 17. But verses 4 through 14, we have the rejection of the true shepherd, Smalley and Yeratla, and the commission to the prophet in verses 4 through 6. Thus says Jehovah my God, feed the flock of Slotim, whose possessors slay them and hold themselves not guilty, and they that sell them say, blessed be Jehovah, for I am rich, and their own shepherds pity them not. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, says Jehovah, but I will deliver the men, every one into his neighbor's hand, into the hand of his king. And they shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them. In verses 4 through 6, the prophet receives the commission to play a role, a messianic role, meaning a role the Messiah will play in the future, the role of the Good Shepherd, as fulfilled in John chapter 10, John 10. And in verse 4, he focuses on the flock he should feed. Thus says Jehovah my God, Zechariah's God, feed the flock of slaughter. The flock of slaughter means a flock already destined for slaughter. The flock represents Israel, and the slaughter they're destined for the slaughter are verses 1, 2, and 3. A flock destined for destruction. And in verses 5 and 6, he describes the condition of the flock, and the condition involves two things. First of all, in verse 5, it's a flock that has been abandoned by man. The possessors slay them and hold themselves not guilty. In the context of the fulfillment, the possessors were the Romans, who periodically let their troops loose and killed the hundreds of Jews at a time and never held themselves guilty. And furthermore, their own shepherds, the Jewish leaders, also failed to pity them. They say, blessed be Jehovah, for I am rich. And so they sell the sheep in order to become rich. This was especially true of the Sadducees. And their own shepherds pitied them not. And that was true of both Pharisees and Sadducees. But not only is this flock abandoned by man in verse 5, it's also abandoned by God in verse 6. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land. But lo, I will deliver the man, every man, to the hand of his neighbor. And the way this was fulfilled is that when the Jerusalem was besieged, Jerusalem was being defended by three different generals who could not get along with each other. They began fighting among themselves, killing each other's troops, and destroying each other's food supply, causing a massive famine to fall upon the city, which ultimately led to the fall of the city to Roman hands. And so he points out, first of all, a lack of pity will mean there'll be civil strife with Jews fighting Jews, and secondly, into the hand of his king will I deliver them. And the king in that day happened to be Caesar, as the Sadducees affirmed it, the chief priests affirmed it at the trial. And in John 19, verse 15, they cry out, we have no king but Caesar. We have no king but Caesar. So since they own Caesar as king, into Caesar's hand they'll not be delivered. And yes, the land will be smitten in keeping with verses 1, 2, and 3, and there'll be no deliverance. Out of their hand I will not deliver them. According to Josephus, by the time the war came to an end, 1,100,000 Jews were killed over a four-year period, and 97,000 were taken into slavery. So that is Zechariah's commission. Now, on the small beam, verses 7 through 11, he will carry out this commission. So I fed the flock of slaughter, verily the poor of the flock, and I took unto me two staves, the one I call Beauty and the other I call Bands, and I fed the flock. And I cut off three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was weary of them, and the soul also loathed me. Then said I will not feed you. Thou which is to die, let it die. Thou which is to be cut off, let it be cut off. And let him that is left eat every one the flesh of another. I took my staff Beauty and cut asunder, that I might break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. And it was broken in that day, and thus the poor of the flock that gave heed unto me knew there was the word of Jehovah. As he carries out the commission, verses 7 through 11, in verse 7, we read about the feeding of the flock of slaughter. So I fed the flock of slaughter, initially the flock as a whole, but then there was a special emphasis on the poor of the flock. And while the offer of his messiahship and his benefits were made to the whole flock, the benefits were especially given to those who accepted, to those who believed, a point made in Matthew 9, verses 35 and 36. Matthew 9, 35 and 36. And so the offer was made for the nation as a whole, but the ones who really benefited were the believing remnant of that day. He says, I took unto me two staves, the one I call beauty, and the word means beauty in the sense of graciousness. And this first staff was for the purpose of protection, to protect the flock from outside attacks. The other one I call bands or binding. This was for the purpose of preserving the flock's unity and keeping them together. So one staff was aggressive to beat off the attackers. The second staff was friendly to keep the sheep together to avoid them being scattered. And he says, I fed the flock. The flock was fed and the commission he was given was fulfilled. Verse 30 points out that his feeding the flock did not come without opposition. A cut of three shepherds in 1 month. He received opposition from three localities. And based upon the fulfillment, the three points of opposition were from the Pharisees and Sadducees and the scribes. And there was mutual antagonism. For my soul was weary of them, and their soul also loathed me. A good example of this is found in Matthew 23. And as the Messiah closes his public ministry in Matthew 23, the whole chapter is just one theme, his renunciation of the scribes and Pharisees for leading the nation to reject his messianic claims. Then verse 9 talks about a point of time when there was a cessation of the feeding. Then said I will not feed you. At some point, there was a rupture between the good shepherd and the people as a whole. And so he ended the feeding in order to leave them to natural causes. That which dies, let it die. That which is to be cut off, let it be cut off. Let them that are left eat everyone the flesh of another. And in verse 10, as part of the cessation, he broke one of the staff's beauty. And now grace and protection is removed. That I break my covenant, which I made with all the peoples, a covenant that was protecting Israel from Gentile invasion and Gentile destruction. And now, as a result of this rupture, the Gentiles will be able to allow to be come in and hurt Israel. Something he himself prophesies in Luke chapter 19, verses 41 through 44. Luke 19, 41 through 44. In Luke chapter 21, verse 24, Luke 21, 24. As to when the rapture occurs in Matthew chapter 12, verses 22 to 45. Matthew 12, 22 to 45. That's when the Jewish leaders finally publicly rejected him on the basis of demon possession. And that's when he decreed that they were guilty of the unpardonable sin. And the offer of the Messianic kingdom was withdrawn from that generation of Israel. It was rescinded from that generation and now destined to be reoffered to a future Jewish generation that will accept it. The Jewish generation will be living in the tribulation. But the generation of his day has lost out on the privilege of seeing the kingdom established in their day. So as he withdraws the kingdom offered in Matthew 12, the nature of his ministry changes radically in four areas. First of all, until Matthew 12, when he performed his miracles, he did it for the benefit of the nation. He did not require them to have faith first. And a good example of this is in John chapter 5, the healing of the man at the pool of Bethesda. And Jesus simply healed on his own initiative. The man didn't even know who Jesus was. As soon as he was asked who healed you, he did not even know who healed him. Had to go back and find out. He didn't know who Jesus was. He didn't know who he claimed to be. There was no faith on this man's part at all. At that point, faith was not essential for these miracles to occur. They were there to get them to believe. But now after Matthew 12, he'll perform miracles only by responding to needs of individuals. And now he will require them to have faith first, a picture of going from the flock as a whole to the poor of the flock, those who believed. Also until Matthew 12, when he healed anybody, he told them, go and proclaim what great things God has done for you. After Matthew 12, every time he heals someone, he tells them, don't tell anyone what God has done for you. He initiates a policy of silence, and those who benefit from his messianic power forbidden to tell anyone about it. Another way we see these changes that until Matthew 12, his miracles were for the nation to get them to believe. After Matthew 12, his miracles are for the apostles to train them for their work in the book of Acts. Another way we see this change is the message that he and the apostles will be proclaiming. Until Matthew 12, both he and they were all over Israel, city to city and synagogue to synagogue, proclaiming Jesus to be the Messiah. After Matthew 12, he will even forbid the apostles to tell anyone who he is. So Matthew chapter 16, for example, when Peter makes his famous confession and says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the God, the living one. The Messiah, Jesus says to Peter, don't tell anyone I am the Messiah. And they too must follow the new policy of silence until that will be rescinded with the Great Commission of Matthew 28. And one more way we see this change as a result of the rapture Zechariah prophesies about. Until Matthew 12, when he taught the people publicly, he did so clearly and distinctly in ways they could and did understand. After Matthew 12, whenever he teaches publicly, it's always parabolically, as in Matthew chapter 13. And when the disciples ask him, why have you begun teaching them in parables? He points out two reasons. First of all, for the apostles, the parables will illustrate the truth. But for the masses that choose not to believe, the purpose will be to hide the truth. And so as Zechariah prophesied, at a certain point in his public feeding of the flock, there'll be a rupture, and the focus will be on the poor of the flock from then on. So in verse 11, we see the effect on the poor of the flock was broken in that day. Thus the poor of the flock that gave heed unto me knew it was the word of Jehovah. And while most of the nation didn't realize what was happening in Matthew 12, the believers began to recognize. So when Jesus warned them in Luke chapter 21, verse 20 and 21, Luke 21, verse 20 and 21, that when the revolt against Rome takes place, they are not to take up weapons to defend the city, they were to abandon the city and flee. And indeed, when the city was besieged, the Jewish believers of that day in AD 66 took that the sign that Jesus promised to give them. They knew they must not take up weapons to help defend the city, but to abandon it. But with the Romans right outside, they couldn't do so very easily. Now, the then Roman governor, Sestus Gallus, thought he was facing only a local revolt. He didn't realize it was a grassroots national revolt. And Jewish guerrilla forces were cutting his supply lines. And so he was forced to lift the siege, and so Jerusalem was temporarily free of the siege. And that's when the whole Messianic community abandoned the city and moved to the city of Pella, P-E-L-L-A, P-E-L-L-A, just on the east side of the river and south of the Sea of Galilee, where they waited the war out in that place. Now, in the small scene of Atlam, in verses 12 through 14, we come to the price of the Good Shepherd. I said unto them, if you think good, give me my hire, and if not, forbear. And so they wait for my hire 30 pieces of silver. And Jehovah said unto me, cast it unto the potter, the goodly prize that I was prized at by them. And I took 30 pieces of silver and cast them into the potter in the house of Jehovah. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Now in verse 12 we read about the attitude of the Jewish leaders. And now God tells Zechariah to appear before the Jewish elders and say, we did not agree to any salary in advance. So the work I've done in feeding the flock is worth something to you, pay me accordingly. If it's worth nothing to you, it's okay to pay me nothing. It would have been less insulting to pay him nothing, but to show the contempt for the prophet, they give him 30 pieces of silver. And that was not an accidental price. In the Mosaic law, in the book of Exodus chapter 21 and verse 32, The law says if you owned an ox, and this ox gored to death your neighbor's slave, you're obligated to pay your neighbor 30 pieces of silver. That was the value price of a dead slave. As Old Testament history progressed, it became a symbolic price of contempt. If you were to show contempt for someone, you would give them 30 pieces of silver, conveying, how much are you worth? You're worth the price of a dead slave. And now in Zechariah 11, we have the prophecy with Messiah that someday he himself will be betrayed by the price of a dead slave. And the chief priests were negotiating with Judas to show the contempt for Jesus. They didn't settle for 29 or 31 to avoid the stigma of 30. They settled for 30 to show their contempt for the one claiming to be the Messiah, and sold out the God-man for the price of a dead slave. Now, in this verse, notice what God says to Zechariah. This is verse 13. This was the goodly prize I was prized of by them. The goodly prize I was prized of by them. And what God tells Zechariah is that someday himself will be sold out for the price of a dead slave. And that happened when the chief priests negotiated with Judas. Now keep in mind that 30 pieces of silver came from the chief priest, and the origin of all funds for the chief priests came out of the temple treasury. Now one major purpose of the temple treasury was to purchase sacrifices. Then that was not their intent that day. Now that's what they did that day. They purchased the final sacrifice for sin. And God tells Zechariah to simply take the 30 pieces and throw it in the potter's there at the temple compound, just as Judas would do centuries later. The fulfillment of this is Matthew chapter 26, verses 14 through 16. Matthew 26, verses 14 through 16. As he carries out the commission, he says, I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them into the potter in the house of Jehovah, as Judas would do in Matthew 27, verses 3 through 10. Matthew 27, verses 3 through 10. So in verse 14, we have the breaking of the second staff, bands. I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, the purpose that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. As the unity of the Jewish people is destroyed, factions form against civil strife within the walled city, causes further unnecessary killing and destruction of food supply. As a result, the city will fall. And the events of verses 4 through 14 brought about the first Roman invasion of AD 70, from 66 to AD 70. But he mentions a second reason for the devastation of verses 1, 2, and 3, and that is that someday accept a foolish shepherd, that'll bring about the second devastation. And while some identified this to be the Antichrist, I think it was fulfilled more closer to the time with the first, with the second Jewish revolt under a man named Simon Bar Kokhba. And Simon Bar Kokhba was declared by the rabbis to be the Messiah. And so there was a second revolt against Rome. And that brought about the second massive devastation and further expulsion from the land. As far as what this teaches us about the Messiah, let me point out several things. Number one, Messiah's first coming will be rejected, especially by the leaders. Messiah's first coming will be rejected, but especially by the leaders. Secondly, a remnant of the Jewish people will accept. A remnant will follow. Thirdly, the leaders will sell the Messiah out for 30 pieces of silver. The leaders will sell Messiah out for 30 pieces of silver. Fourthly, the result of rejection is two things. The result of rejection is two things. First of all, protection is removed, open to the attacks of AD 70 and AD 135. And secondly, unity is removed, causing a dispersion of Israel. His fifth point in this chapter was, and because they reject the true Messiah, they'll accept the false one. Now go to Zechariah chapter 12. Now Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10 is in the context of Armageddon, in the context of Israel's national salvation. But there's one element here that would reflect back to the first coming. Look at chapter 12, verse 10. I'll pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. They shall look unto me whom they have pierced. They shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, shall be in bitterness for him as one who is in bitterness for his firstborn. Now all of this is still future, but they refer to something in the past. They will look unto the one whom they previously pierced, and the piercing occurs at the first coming. And whereas at the time of the piercing they did not believe in him, in the future time they will believe in the one whom they have pierced. So in this context, it makes two basic points about the first coming. Number one, the Messiah is rejected by Israel. His first coming is rejected. And secondly, the Messiah will be pierced. The piercing was done twice. First of all, by the nails at the time of the crucifixion. And secondly, by the spear piercing his side right after his own death. Now go to page 5 on your outline and look at Zechariah chapter 13. Again, most of the context of Zechariah 13, this is prophetic, is still future, but look at verse 7, chapter 13, verse 7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man that is my fellow, says Jehovah of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. I'll turn my hand upon the little ones. Now, verse 7 begins with the fact of the rejection of the Messiah. He points out in verse 7, the Messiah will die a violent death. Also notice it's against my shepherd, God's shepherd. And this is a summary of chapter 11. This is the messianic shepherd of verses 4 through 14, focusing on his humanity. He goes on to say, against the man that is, in my translation, my fellow. You might have a different translation. But the meaning of the Hebrew word simply means mine equal. Against the man that is mine equal, says Jehovah of hosts. And to be God's equal requires you to be God. Again, you have a God-man concept here. The result of the smiting of the shepherd, the sheep are scattered. He then moves on to things not yet fulfilled. What this passage teaches about the first coming is three things. Number one, the Messiah will be the God-man. The Messiah will be the God-man. Secondly, he will die a violent death. He will die a violent death. And thirdly, this will result in the dispersion of the flock. It will result in the dispersion of the flock. The last example from the prophets, let's go to the Italian prophet, Malachi. Malachi chapter 3. This is the one verse that correlates with what we looked at yesterday and 2 days ago, chapter 40 of Isaiah, verse 3, the prophecy of a forerunner for the Messiah. Behold, I send my messenger, that he shall prepare the way before me. The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant, whom you desire, behold, he comes, says Jehovah of hosts. So before the messenger of the covenant comes, we have another messenger that will precede him. It is one of the two passages fulfilled by John the Baptist, and the Messiah's appearance was to be preceded by the coming of a forerunner. Let's go ahead and begin the writings. We're not going to do all of these. We're going to do some of these. We can finish that in some other facets tomorrow night. And now turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 17. 1 Chronicles 17. Now, 1 Chronicles chapter 17, verses 10 through 14 provide the content of the Davidic covenant. And it corresponds with a parallel passage in 2 Samuel 7, verses 11 through 16. 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 16. There's a couple of the points of differences. The Samuel passage focuses on David's immediate son, Solomon. Again, the Samuel passage focuses on David's immediate son, Solomon. And therefore, in that passage, you have the possibility of sinning, you have the need for divine discipline. But in this passage, the focus is on David's distant son, the Messiah. And by virtue of the distant son, this passage does not mention the possibility of sinning or the possibility of any need for discipline. Is that a cell phone? Okay. Is it a computer? Okay. And in these verses, what God promises David is four eternal things. Four eternal things. First of all, an eternal house or dynasty. Secondly, an eternal throne. Thirdly, an eternal kingdom. And fourthly, an eternal descendant. An eternal house or dynasty, the throne, kingdom, and descendant. And the eternality of the first three, the house and throne and kingdom, is guaranteed because the seed of David culminates in one who is himself eternal, the Messianic God-man. Where's that coming from? It's the answer machine? Well, it works. Now, what this passage does for the Messianic Christology is, first of all, limits the seed we've spoken of previously to the house of David within the tribe of Judah. Now, the first seed we noticed in our series is the seed of Domin, which means the Messiah must come out of humanity. The second seed was the seed of Abraham, which means he must come out of Jewish humanity. And the third seed will be the seed of Judah, he must come from the tribe of Judah. But now with this passage, the Messiah must come out of only one family of Judah, the family of David. It'll be limited only one more step in Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 24 to 30. Jeremiah 22, verses 24 to 30. Where he must come from a line that is distinct from the line of Jeconiah. And therefore we have Mary's genealogy showing she came from Nathan. The second thing about this prophecy is, again, it requires the Messiah to appear sometime before the year AD 70, because it would not be possible to show Davidic descent after AD 70. Now turn to the book of Psalms, beginning with Psalm 2. Psalm 2. Psalm 2 as a whole, again, is something still prophetic, describing a time when all the nations of the armies of the world come against the Lord and against his anointed one, but God will establish his king in the city of Jerusalem. But there are a couple of things relevant to our Messianic Christology. Because this psalm points out, first of all, the Messiah is the Son of God. The Messiah is the Son of God. It's referred to as Son twice in this passage. Verse 7, I will tell the decree, Jehovah said to me, you are my Son. Because they have I begotten you. And verse 12, kiss the Son, lest he be angry. Secondly, the Messiah is destined as also a king. He'll rule in Jerusalem, but also over the Gentiles. But the main point is the Messiah is uniquely the Son of God. Messiah is uniquely the Son of God. Now go to Psalm 16. Psalm 16. Now verses 1 and 2 points out the Messiah's refuge is with God the Father, and in verse 3, Messiah's delight is with the saints. And in verses 4 through 9, God the Father is the Messiah's total trust. And then in verse 10, he says, "You will not leave my soul in Sheol, neither will you suffer your Holy One to see corruption. You will show me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. In your right hand there are pleasures forevermore." And note that this is a promise that while the soul of the Messiah ends up in Sheol as a result of his death, the good side of Sheol in Abraham's bosom of paradise, but the soul will not be left there, and God the Father will raise the Messiah back to life. As a result of being resurrected, he will then be in the presence of God, and more important, he'll be at the right hand of God. We can see 3 points here. First of all, the Messiah will have a unique relationship with God the Father. Unique relationship with God the Father. Secondly, the Messiah will die. And thirdly, the Messiah will be resurrected from the dead. This is a Psalm of David, so the death of the Messiah was already known in David's day, but notice that death here is not said to be substitutionary. And again, the fact Messiah would actually die for sin was first made in Isaiah 53. So you have previously death passages, but not the reason for the death. Okay. I think Psalm 22, I'm going to spend some time on. So tomorrow we'll pick it up with Psalm 22. We'll definitely finish the writing. So what else we do in the outline, we'll see how time goes. A couple announcements before we take our offering. I've been mentioning different facets of our ministries, and our primary goal is that of getting the gospel out to Jewish people. Our second major goal is discipleship of both Jewish and Gentile believers. What we added since my last visit here is the discipleship that you can take from the computer. If you go to our webpage and you can click on the phrase that says come and see, what we're developing is a 4-stage curriculum, and this is the first stage that is already ready. It has 50 lessons, and in those, each lesson is about 12 minutes long, and there's a test at the end you can take on your own. And it'll give you a comprehensive view of the Bible as a whole with the Jewish backgrounds as well. So I encourage this, and it's all free. It's all free. So go ahead and plug in and to rel.org, push on the come and see. And then we'll have 2 other stages developing in the next very, very shortly so that you can eventually finish all 3 categories. The 4th one will be and starting to have your own discipleship classes and different facets. And so I encourage you to take that program, and and you can learn a lot from it, and it's all free. Also, certain people in churches have been called to be prayer warriors for the church and for missions. And if you're a prayer warrior, one of the booklets we put out, only to those who want it and promise to pray, is this booklet that comes out every 2 months. It comes out 6 times a year. And as you look at this booklet, you will see the different branches and the previous requests that have been answered, followed by new prayer requests. I've left some new ones out on the table for those of you that would like to get one. We'd like to be received as regularly for the purpose of praying for different facets of our ministry. And I go through this myself in my quiet time. I usually pick one page at a time to pray through and then just repeat it till a new booklet comes out. Just simply give me a note in a piece of paper and just put down prayer booklet, and I'll make sure you get this regularly if you'd like to be part of our prayer ministry. All right, we'll go ahead and follow the same procedure as previously. We'll have our offering for your ministries, followed by a closing song for people who can slip out if need to. But again, for Thursday, we'll have our next question and answer session right for the closing number. Okay, floor is open. If you have a question, raise your hand. We'll go from there. Excuse me, I do have one question written for my take first. Does or will God require animal sacrifices in the future? And the answer is yes, and the details are given in the book of Ezekiel, chapters 40 through 48. Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48 talks about the millennial temple and the millennial sacrificial system. It is not a reinstitution of the Mosaic system. There's too many details which are quite different and contradictory between the Mosaic and the Ezekiel sacrifices. There'll be a new system of sacrifices under kingdom law once the kingdom is established. As to reasons for it, there's three basic reasons for it. Keep in mind, not even the Mosaic sacrifices brought salvation. People were saved by grace through faith apart from any work. And the purpose of the Mosaic sacrifices was to restore fellowship of the Old Testament saint that sinned. It wasn't a means of earning salvation. So the factors would be as follows. While the Mosaic sacrifices look forward to Messiah's death, the Ezekiel sacrifices look back on it. We, the church, have been commanded to do something physical, to partake of the bread and the cup, to show forth the Lord's death till he return. Until he return means that the bread and the cup ceremony will terminate with the second coming. At that point, there'll be a blood sacrifice to him for the same purpose, to show forth his death. Secondly, for there'll also be a means of restoring fellowship for the millennial saint. For us, the means of restoring fellowship is by means of 1 John 1:9. We confess our sins. He's faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. But for the people in the kingdom, it'll be a sacrificial system. A third major purpose is they'll be living in a theocracy. One of the means of receiving theocratic blessings in a theocracy is to be cleansed from ritual uncleanness. So third purpose is to cleanse ritual uncleanness for the purpose of receiving the theocratic blessings of a theocratic kingdom. But if we take the Bible literally, we always should take it literally unless it says otherwise, there will be a sacrificial system in the future. All right, the floor is open for questions back there. Within our circles, there are different views. My own view is that a Gog and Magog war will occur sometime before the tribulation starts, and minimally about 3.5 years or more before the tribulation starts. Because the outcome of the war is that it's going to take 7 years to burn military equipment. And therefore, the burning of the military equipment has to be completed no later than the midpoint of the tribulation. Because at the midpoint is when the Jewish people flee the land and will need the weaponry, and they won't have time to burn it. And so I would take it to be a pre-tribulational event, not necessarily pre-rapture. Rapture could come even tonight. It will happen before the tribulation, minimally 3.5 years or more. Question? Any other questions? If they can show me one verse that puts the church in any part of the tribulation, they'll have a convert. But there's no such verse that points that out. Sometimes they simply assume that the wrath of God begins only in the middle of the tribulation. Now, in the book of Revelation, the midpoint of the tribulation is in chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, when the Gentiles take over the temple and rule it for 3.5 years. That's the midpoint. And the wrath of God is already mentioned with the first judgments in Revelation chapter 6, the wrath of God and the wrath of the Lamb. And the church is not exempt from persecution, but the church is exempt from the wrath of God. And therefore, the rapture has to happen before the tribulation even starts. So we will not be in any part of the tribulation. Question? I can give you a comment or two. That's as much as I can talk about them that way. But the emerging church is, from their own writers, is still emerging. And they haven't come to any conclusions. But they're mostly characterized by things they don't believe in, rather than clearly spelling out what they do believe in. I haven't seen any of them produce a doctrinal statement. Here's what the emerging church stands for. But they don't accept this, they don't accept that, they don't accept that, they don't accept this. So to me, just a mass theological confusion. And again, the focus is to change the church to be more conformed to 21st century society and to bend to the demands of the culture of the 21st century and so on. But it has no clear doctrinal statement, no clear goal that I've seen. And different emerging writers say different things about the emerging movement. There's no unity even among the leaders. So it's, again, part of the apostasy of the church and things of that nature. And the further away they get into the Bible, the more confused they get. And what a church needs to do is expound the Word of God. And the emerging church will not do that. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? All right, we'll have our last session tomorrow night.